This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 33. And we have a really great one for you today. Kai Chang Tom, direct from Toronto, will be our guest. And we are going to be talking about social justice, activism, and making these movements less elitist and more inclusive, among other things. And she just brings a ton of nuance to these conversations that I really appreciated, and I think you'll really appreciate it. It was just a great talk, lots of stuff to take away from this one. But before we get there, just some quick business. As always, I would really appreciate if you would go onto iTunes and rate and review the show. That's how we get out in front of people, as I understand it. And also, please go like, or you can find us on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. You can find the Instagram is at The Radical Therapist. Please come find us there. And the website is theradicaltherapist.com. And you can always send me an email, and I appreciate getting emails. If you want stickers, I'd be happy to send them to you, Radical Therapist stickers. Just shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And I also want to keep announcing that there is now a Radical Therapist YouTube channel. And this week we just released, or I just released a new video on, with the title, Is Attachment Theory Overrated? So creating a lot of buzz. I think you'll like that video. And also my last one on decolonizing family therapy brought the haters out. So I think you don't want to miss that one. Even the comment section is worth it. I was accused of not being able to, not being qualified to counsel a squirrel, so among other things. So you might want to go check that out. That's the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. And you can find that, just Google, find it on YouTube, search my name, Chris Hoff, H-O-F-F, or The Radical Therapist, or you can go just to the website and get a link there. So if you could do all that stuff, we would really appreciate it. We want to connect and engage with you on social media, on all our social media, so please do that. So without further ado, I want to get to our guest, Kai Chang Tom. And before we do that, I'll tell you a little bit about her. Kai Chang Tom is a writer, performer, therapist, lollipop lover, and wicked witch who divides her heart between Montreal and Toronto, unceded Indigenous territories. She is the author of the novel Fierce Femmes and Notorious Liars, a dangerous trans girl's confabulous memoir from Metonymy Press, which was a 2017 Lambda Literary Award nominee, as well as the collection of poetry, A Place Called No Homeland on Arsenal Pulp Press. And she has been published widely in print and online in BuzzFeed, Autostraddle, Everyday Feminism, Asian American Literary Review, The Capiliano Review, and others. She sings with the wind, wanders with the ocean, and sends you love. So without further ado, let's meet Kai Chang. All right. Well, welcome to the show, Kai Chang.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Yeah, I appreciate you making the time. I know we tried to do this a couple of times, and I appreciate your flexibility, but we made it happen, and here we are. So,
yeah, no worries.
And I guess, you know, before we get talking about your article that really captured my attention and wanted me to reach out to you and speak with you, and that article, just so for our listeners, was entitled, I found it in the site Everyday Feminism. And it was titled 9 Ways We Can Make Social Justice Movements Less Elitist and More Accessible. And the title certainly caught my interest. And then I just thought it was a really great article. But before we get there, I just kind of wanted to maybe ask you a little bit about you. You do many things, including writing and performing, spoken word, drag dance. But you also studied social work at McGill University. And co-founded Monster Academy Montreal, which is a radical mental health initiative for youth. And I guess I'm wondering, can you say more about what prompted you or to kind of study social work and this work you're doing for youth?
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I think you must have found a slightly out of date bio on the internet. There are a lot floating around. It's cool.
Okay.
But yeah, so I finished a master's degree in social work about 2 years ago, and then I followed that with a second master's in couple and family therapy.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah, I'm a clinical social worker and MFT, and then I moved to Toronto. So I'm currently working in the public sector at a children's mental health agency, doing individual and family therapy for trans youth and their parents and siblings. So, you know, like the trajectory follows, but things are a little different now.
Sure.
And Monster Academy was really kind of like, was, you know, for me, a miraculous kind of flowering of a project that was a collaboration between myself and a dear, dear friend of mine who, you know, I spent a lot of time, many years growing up with together in Montreal through different journeys of exploring activism and mental health and psychology. And really, you know, how the project started was we were both students at the time. I think that they were a student in psychology and I was finishing up my first master's in social work. And we just ran into each other at actually an anarchist conference in a small town, in a small city in Canada called Kingston, Ontario. And we were struck by how intense, you know, that anarchism was among sort of our youth demographic, about how much rhetoric there was around rage and, like the expression of justified anger about systemic oppressions toward minorities who were racialized, class oppressed, trans, that sort of thing. And, you know, although we found ourselves resonating with that, we also really struggled because we were like, well, we were thinking that there needed also to be room to not be angry all the time, to be softer, to experience sadness and depression, to not feel strong, all of these kinds of things. And so what we did was we started having a series of conversations, just kind of informally. We made each other dinner a lot. And drank wine a lot, and we talked about what it was we wished we had in high school in terms of a mental health model that was engaged with activism and the kinds of oppressions that we were experiencing as trans and genderqueer people in the world. And from that was born this idea of a school for monsters, a place where it was okay to be vengeful and full of rage, or depressed and suicidal, or manic and psychotic. A place where we could come as we were, and yet still be ready to learn and to adapt our ways of seeing the world into different kinds of frameworks, where we could learn self-care that wasn't kind of, you know, proselytizing about how bad we were at taking care of ourselves, and where we could learn about social justice in a way that similarly wasn't proselytizing about how oppressed or oppressive we were being to others, a place where we could learn and be safe and change and grow in the ways that we needed to grow. And the title Monster Academy just came out of this feeling of being monstrous all the time and trying to embrace that and see that for the power and beauty that monsters can be. So that's how that project started. And we decided we really wanted it to be a grassroots initiative that broke away from the NGO model that is so popular in Canada and the United States. So we decided that, you know, we could do it on a shoestring budget. We had a Kickstarter. No, did we? Oh, yeah, we didn't have a Kickstarter. Sorry, we had a fundraising campaign that was targeted mostly through letter writing. And I think what we ended up doing was we sent letters to all of our friends we knew who were rich or had rich parents and pulled together a budget. We also got a few grants and launched this program, which was a free mental health school for marginalized youth. And, you know, there were many ups and downs with that project. I think we would do it differently now if we were to do it again. But, yeah, that was a blessing. And so, you know, that's really, I think, that story encapsulates the roots of where I come from in terms of activism that I hope to do in new and different kinds of ways than I was exposed to as an adolescent.
Great. And yeah, maybe that leads us into your article. It sounds like you had a lot of different experiences and which maybe led to this. And you start your article, the 9 ways we can make social justice movements less elitist and more accessible, by stating that you stopped calling yourself an activist in your first year in college. And I'm assuming, could you say more about that experience or why you decided to do that?
Sure. Well, you know, it wasn't like a clear cut, like, all right, today I'm no longer an activist, sure. You know? Sure. And I still, that term has still, you know, been applied to me on and off or whatever. But so, yeah. But I mean, all that to say, I think that's in the article itself. It's been a while since I wrote that article, but I think it's in the article too. That I went to McGill University, which is in Montreal, Canada, and it's known in Canada to be kind of an elite school. In the way that schools in Canada can be elite, we don't have like an intense private school system in the way that the U.S. does, so things are a little bit different. Okay. But still, you know, it's known to be like, you know, I think one of its nicknames is the Harvard of the North, which is kind of ridiculous, you know, and I think really speaks to how hard it's trying. And what that meant for me was actually that, you know, that there were people with mostly who were of a huge class difference from where I came from. And, you know, that translated in the activism as well. When I emerged into the undergraduate sphere, I was looking for a community. And so what I did was I went straight for the hubs of queer activism on campus because I identified as queer at the time, and I had some really great experiences with queer activism in my community in downtown Vancouver, and so I was hoping to kind of replicate that in some ways. And what I found instead was that the kinds of activism that were happening, for better or for worse, were very much centered on the kinds of communities that dominated McGill, which is to say white and middle class, or, you know, frankly, upper class and wealthy. Sure. So there was a lot of academic talk about Judith Butler and like how gender is a performance and a lot of gender theory. And to be honest, you know, I think all that stuff is quite valuable to me now. But the ways that it was being talked about, and, you know, part of this, I think, has to do with mm-hmm. the way that youth and adolescence and activism can kind of turn activism into cliques or kinds of, or different kinds of like bullying. I really just found that the activism there was, you know, not applicable to me. It felt like I was being made to feel like I didn't know enough, like I was stupid, like I was somehow being oppressive for wanting to wear nice clothes when in fact I came. It was really important to front, you know, to pretend that you had more money than you did, and that was like that was an interesting relationship that we had with being working class. I won't say poor because we weren't. That was really wasn't understood by the upper middle class students that I met at McGill, who, on the other hand, I think were fronting it really hard and pretending to be poor in some ways to legitimize their activism. And so that was why I decided to stop calling myself an activist, because, you know, I felt like everyone at McGill was wearing ripped denim and had a bunch of tattoos and had to have an asymmetrical haircut. And, you know, I wasn't part of the club. And, you know, as I spoke more and more to people at McGill, who, you know, came from similar class backgrounds to me, or who were, you know, otherwise not the white middle class of Canada and the States, I realized that I wasn't the only one having that experience. And then as I spoke more to people who were, you know, in those groups of activism, I realized that they also were not feeling too great about the ways that activism was playing out. And so that was why, you know, I realized I didn't feel like I was part of activism. And, you know, similarly today, I still find myself distanced from a lot of activist communities because I engage really differently with the class dynamic, or I engage really differently with the race and gender dynamic. Even though as a trans woman of color, I think that my identity is sometimes fetishized by activism. So, I mean, I call myself these days a community worker or a social worker or an artist if I need to call myself something. But more and more, I like to just call myself a person, you know, who tries to be engaged in the communities that I live in.
Right. Well, maybe that moves me to maybe ask about, you wrote something really nice in your article about social justice being such a beautiful, powerful part of your life that you needed to open it up to those you care about, from your 15-year-old sister to your corporate lawyer friends to your racist grandparents. Can you say more about that?
Sure. Well, you know, I wrote that article, I think maybe about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So my feelings on this have shifted a little bit. But, you know, I think to speak to the spirit of what it was, I was talking about how when I was a teenager, when I was in my mid-teens, I encountered activism and it set me free. It like liberated me in a way. I think it feels very liberating to a lot of people who first encounter feminism or anti-racism or intersectional feminism, these different kinds of activism that are becoming, thankfully, more and more popular. popular in the North American mainstream. Those kinds of activism allowed me to see myself as not someone just to be tolerated because of my difference, but someone who could stand in the power of my difference and celebrate myself in that, and who could find community in difference and belonging in a desire to change the way society worked. So, you know, it really felt at the time like I was discovering a new world and seeing things in a totally different way. And I think that, you know, a lot of young and, you know, I think activists of any age, actually, who first encounter activist ways of thinking, experience that beautiful blossoming, you know, that like, wow, like I'm encountering a way of thinking that is setting me free. And I wanted that, you know, I wanted that for my younger sister, who at the time was in the middle of high school, and I knew she was going to encounter the same kinds of racism that I did. I wanted it for my grandparents, who, you know, I simplified that, but, you know, by calling them racist in the article, but, sure. You know, my grandparents were people who immigrated from rural China in the 1950s. And so, you know, were really, you know, not free in a lot of ways because they didn't speak English and they were poor for most of their lives. And I wanted activism for them as well. But I knew that, you know, people like my grandparents, for example, who didn't speak English and who really didn't interact with anyone who wasn't Chinese. And, you know, I think we're racist in their ways that they could be very anti-black, or, well, really just kind of racist anyone who wasn't Chinese, in their presentation not only would they not be welcome in activist communities would never be accessible to them because activist communities so much rely on English or in Canada also French, but dominant language is the mainstream and they require people very often to be young, to agree, to conform, And I felt that, you know, my younger sister as well, like, you know, who is a person young, a very intelligent young person, but, maybe would be coming from a different place than a lot of activists I knew, might not necessarily be welcomed in activist community either. And so I felt there was a real injustice in that this this powerful world of revolutionary ideas was only accessible to a few. It seemed hypocritical, you know, of course. And so that was what I meant when I was talking about how I wanted activism to be for everyone. And, you know, obviously that's an idea that comes from many other places as well. I'm thinking particularly of bell hooks' Feminism is for Everyone, or Chimamanda Adichie's Everyone Should Be a Feminist. These ideas that, you know, if properly couched, then activist ideology is really liberating for everyone. But of course, that's easy to say and much less easy to follow through on. And that was what I was speaking to at the time.
Sure. You said it shifted a bit. I know I've come across recently, I even think I read an article recently about this this unapologetic exclusivity in kind of activist movements. And you're talking about more of a kind of an inclusiveness, and I'm wondering if you have some thoughts about that, or do you shift? I'm getting a sense, I hear a theme of a lot of movement in your ideas about a lot of this stuff.
For sure, you know, and I think that's great. I would love to, I mean, please send me that article about unapologetic exclusivity, because I would love to read it. I think I've moved. I mean, you know, I'm glad, you know, it's really interesting to think about unapologetic exclusivity, and I should check on that, but where I am right now is I'm kind of, you know, I've shifted even further toward thinking like, well, like, if activism isn't something that can be structured for, say, my grandparents, like, I'm going to take my grandparents as a recurring example, because they are examples to me of people who are really close, whom I have a connection to, who really could have used like a liberatory ideology. Sure. My grandparents were, like I said, poor, working class, if you could even say working class, like, you know, they were extremely marginalized people in rural China, even before they moved, like they were of the peasant class and, you know, really struggling. My grandfather was, you know, according to family legend, I'll never know how true that is, you know, imprisoned in a Japanese war camp during the invasion in World War II. So these are people who are like really, really suffering in a lot of ways. And when they came to Canada, they really, you know, attempted to hold on to the model minority immigrant dream without speaking English, right?
Right.
And, you know, two generations later, here I am like a professional therapist. So, you know, something worked out right. for them. But, you know, over the course of that struggle and sacrifice, I wonder how it would have been for them if they had had a community that said, you don't have to do this, that you could be in a different way, that my grandmother didn't have to spend her entire life really, like, in my grandfather's house cooking and cleaning, you know, like that there could have been another way. Mm. Now when I think about activism, I wonder, like, when I think about how centralized activism is around youth and universities, sometimes, not always, right? Not always. Right. These are the kind of activism I've encountered. Or when I think about how activism is really centered around, can be centered around, like, the proper use of language and, like, adherence to behavioral norms. Then I wonder, like, you know, could activism ever really be for my grandparents? Like, is that something that they could ever have? Mm. And then I think about how, as a trans woman of color, for myself, like, the kinds of activism I encounter have often been really eager to instrumentalize my voice and my work and my body, you know, like, to be like, okay, like, this trans woman of color is saying things that we agree with, so now they can be true, you know, like, I've been used as a token a lot of the time. To this day, you know, people are really eager to have me sit on their anti-racist committees or their anti-oppression committees, even though I would never actually call myself an expert in anti-racism or even, like, necessarily an expert in, like, trans issues. Like, I would say I have familiarity with, like, my own life as a racialized, as an Asian person and as a trans person. And, you know, I have some, I guess, expertise in the intersection of mental health and trans issues because that's what I have studied and worked with for such a long time now. But, you know, it's fascinating to me how that activism has used me in a lot of ways, but hasn't necessarily improved my life. You know, like, being a token hasn't necessarily made me any more financially stable. It hasn't given me any more access to safety on the street. And on the other hand, activist communities, and I really want to be clear, I mean activist communities that I've encountered, like, I think, you know, I don't know all about activism or intersectional feminism all across the states or Canada or whatever, but the kinds I have encountered have, you know, been eager to use me as a symbol, and then I've also watched other trans women be torn down for saying the wrong thing. And a really close friend of mine, whom I won't name, we were talking to this other, to a young trans woman friend of ours, and we were talking about, you know, try to avoid the famous trans woman game if you can. It's really easy to become famous as a trans woman if you start to say activist stuff or, you know, get a YouTube, because they'll raise you up to tear you down. I feel really cynical about that these days, even as I also feel a renewed sense of joy and confidence in my ability to connect with people who don't necessarily identify as activists or who aren't necessarily feminists, but who believe in a liberatory, who think in liberatory ways, or who just believe that the world can be better and more inclusive, less oppressive for everyone. So, you know, I think what I mean is I try to stay away from capital A activism while still organizing my life around the values of freedom and equity and reparation for past wrongs. Is that clear?
Yeah, no, I like that. That's the first time I've heard that, capital A activism. I really appreciate that. So, would it be okay to go into your nine suggestions, your nine ways, and maybe talk a little bit about this?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So in your article, you suggested nine ways that we can all work to make our activism more accessible to everyone. And the first one is welcome people who are trying to learn. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes. So I think back to my time at McGill, and when I was, like, really fresh off the turnip truck, you know, as it were.
Sure.
I really wanted to learn. And it felt terrifying to make mistakes. I want to be clear here also that, like I'm sure I said stupid things that were, like, really hurtful just by accident. And that, you know, I'm not asking for a pass on those things. But I do think that it was really interesting to see the ways in which I was expected to behave as a queer person of color, as a teenager person of color coming into an activist space, and, like, kind of automatically know who Judith Butler was, automatically know, like, who Gayatri Spivak was, like, you know, probably a lot of people don't know. I mean, you know, people listening to this podcast don't know who those people are, and that's fine. You actually don't need Judith Butler and Gayatri Spivak, I think, are kind of, you know, maybe not even necessary to revolutionary thought, but, because academics aren't necessary to revolutionary thought. I really want to push that. But it was really assumed that I should know about a lot of academic frameworks of activism. And then, you know, on a more complicated level, I think it was also assumed that I should know about non-standard or non-mainstream pronoun use. And we had this fascinating situation where I didn't know what different pronoun options than he or she could be. I wasn't even familiar with the singular pronoun they at the time, but I was someone who identified as not male or female at the time. And there was a lot of white folks in particular and rich folks at McGill who were telling me that I was bad or that I was wrong or stupid because I didn't know how to use these words, but they were words that, you know, I could have had for myself. And so if someone had just taken a second to be like, to explain to me, then, you know, I think we would have had a really different relationship. And so when I generalize that, I think, you know, I think we need to be really careful about making assumptions about people who are entering activist spaces. It's really easy. And again, I think because activism in university campuses tends to be dominated by the white and wealthy or the racialized and wealthy sometimes too, that we can assume that we know where everyone is coming from. But in fact, this idea that activism is only about like knowing all the right things at the right time is really flawed. And there are people who could really benefit, who are more marginalized than you sometimes, that you're making assumptions about, who need space and time to grow. So that's what really kind of where I'm speaking from. And I don't mean, again, that like we should allow, like we can think about, there's a lot of activist work done, right, around not having to educate someone about your own identity. And I think that's really great. I shouldn't have to educate someone about my own gender, or I shouldn't have to teach a white person how not to be racist, you know? Right. But there are a lot of other people in activist spaces who, for example, are cisgender or who are white who could do that work in like a and who don't really, you know, have no skin in the game other than to educate. And if you want to be an effective ally, then it is your job to educate. I think that that's clear and has been written about as well.
Sure.
Yeah. I think on a more complex level, there's a different range of emotional tools that we can use to engage. And I want to really stress that, you know, like if someone misgenders me in a space, I can legitimately refuse to engage with that person because it's hurtful when I'm misgendered, or I can get angry at that person. I think that's totally valid and legitimate as well. And no one, you know, but if it's a good day and it's a person who might want to have a relationship with, then maybe I can be angry at them and also hold them accountable, or maybe I can be angry at them and also educate them. And I say this as someone who, you know, I've spent a lot of time with partners and family who have needed more time. And it's true that I have the right to be angry at my family or my partners for taking more time to learn how to treat me respectfully. And I should be able to cry or scream about that. No one should be allowed to tone police me around that. At the same time, I should also, I wish that someone had been there to teach me, like, how to express my anger, how to hold my anger differently, how to be with the people I loved, like my family, who I'm just going to be with, right, for the rest of my life, because right. that is how, as a Chinese person, I hold family and bring them with me on a journey, on a different journey. And I think that the idea that, like, the only correct response to someone making a mistake or to someone doing something inadvertently oppressive is to scream at them or to shame them is, you know, a very white cultural thing where, you know, like the idea is you can cut someone off and isolate and shame them and get rid of them in your life. That's a very white colonial idea that we can cut off parts of our community. Many of people of color, on the other hand, come from communities where that's not an option, or it's the option of last resort, not one to be used, like not an option to be used when someone makes a, you know, like a one-time mistake. And this is the fear I see in a lot of activist communities, that if you make one mistake, then, you know, you're banished forever, or you're right. doxxed on the internet or something like this. And this is what I mean. You know, we have access to a wider range of emotional tools and strategies, and I wish that we could use them more.
Great. Moving on to number two, you asked to prioritize physical and economic accessibility. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. You know, this is... really, like, where, you know, I come back to this idea that activism happens in elitist ways in elitist places.
Sure.
So, you know, university campuses or wealthy urban areas, sometimes activism can look like this, like, who has the best grasp of language has the most power, you know, like people who are able to never misgender anyone and never say anything racist or ableist have the most access to space and comfort.
Right.
But I don't know if that should be true. When I think about the way activism is shaped, or like a truly liberatory, a truly universal access space could be shaped, then I think about like prioritizing access to those who have the most need. And so instead of language or like people who have the correct thoughts, I think maybe we should center folks who can't afford to access educational institutions or healthcare, folks who have the most need around linguistic support or mobility support. These different kinds of things, I think, need to be centered to place folks who are at most risk in the center of their activism. An activist I really respect, Cyrus Marcus Ware, in Toronto, talks a lot about centering the lowest common denominator in terms of power. And he cites the example of the black disabled trans woman. You know, understanding black disabled trans women is generally folks who tend to have the least access to power, privilege, and care in society. And that's what I agree with. You know, I think that we should center marginalized folks who are most marginalized and allow our wisdom and our activism to grow from that, instead of trying to force frameworks of activism down on people who don't necessarily have access to places where those frameworks are invented. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very. Okay. Yeah, that's great. I mean, actually, I don't know Cyrus Marcus Ware, but I'll have to look him up. How about number three? You mentioned celebrate age diversity. I know you talked about your grandparents, but can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, just that. I think this is in the article. This is definitely in the article too. A dear friend of mine once said, you know, activist communities aren't communities because there are no elders or children, and so they're just scenes.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Yeah, because they grow and die, you know, they blossom and die really quickly. And that's, you know, something I've noticed is really still true in my life, that activist scenes seem to flower around folks who are in their late teens and up to their mid-20s, and then there are fewer and fewer older people. And of course, I really don't want to discount the work of elders in activist communities, because they are doing so much great work, but it gets harder and harder to be in activist communities as you get older, is what I mean to say. Mm. As one starts to have children, or especially as one is an elder who doesn't have a ton of knowledge or access around using social media and technology, sure. keeping up with different kinds of terminology, it becomes harder and harder. But then, you know, if when I look at young and activist communities who are centered around folks in their late teens and early 20s, I don't see them as being particularly effective. Right? Mm. Like, there's this idea that folks in their 20s have invented anti-racism for the first time, or anti-ableism for the first time, or restorative justice and accountability frameworks for the first time, when, of course, if one bothers to take a look, these ideas have been around since the 70s, since the 50s, right. since way before that, you know? And the most effective activism I see is in communities where there are folks who have been doing activism for a long time and have had the chance to figure out how to make that sustainable for themselves and between each other, where there are children growing into activism, and where there are elders to guide that, you know? So a mentor and friend of mine, Leah Lakshmi Piyapsna Samarasenha, and I were talking once, and she said, she mentioned, you know, like, well, of course, you know, accountability processes aren't always going to work, because you can't just replace the entire criminal justice system in 5 minutes with your friends. Mm-hmm. And when I think about how that's played out among my communities, I'm like, yeah, you can't do that, especially when you're like 21 years old mm-hmm. and don't necessarily have a ton of life experience around transformative justice or creating new and sustainable frameworks. We need elders to help us do that.
That's great. Okay. And number four, you say, and you said a little bit about this, but maybe you have more to say about this, but this idea of making room for mistakes and accountability.
Yes. So I think a lot of folks have written about this before and since I put out that article. Mm-hmm. And I will say I'm having a thought now that this is an interesting time to have this conversation, because one of the most famous feminist vloggers on YouTube, Lacey Green, has been putting out a lot of videos and tweets around this idea of making room for mistakes and different perspectives in activism. Hmm. I don't know if you're aware of that at all.
No, I'm not actually. Okay.
Yeah. It's something to Google. It's a rabbit hole of comments and articles. At the time, I think I was really responding to something a lot of folks in my age cohort were responding to, which was that it felt like you have to be perfect. Like you can't ever make an incorrect statement that's like oppressive or inadvertently kind of racist or, as we say, you know, fucked up. Mm-hmm. Without being banished forever from the internet, right?
Right.
And now when I think about that more, a year or two later, I'm kind of like, well, you know, there can be more nuance in this idea, right? Like, there can be room for mistakes, but also there should be room for safety. But, you know, so when I think about the idea about room for mistakes, I want to, let me try and inject nuance into that, because I don't want to just be like, well, maybe someone can just wear a culturally appropriate costume and then you can say something nice to them, right? Like, so in order to make room for mistakes in accountability, one has to have the faith in the other part, in the party that is being held accountable, that they actually want to make the wrong that they have done right. That they want to address the harm they have done and genuinely create a new relationship. And sometimes that is not possible. I think that in activism, sometimes we need to understand that, like, the other party is not going to change and doesn't want to. Like, the U.S. or Canadian settler colonial governments, right? I think that it's really important to have a healthy suspicion when Canada, which just had its 150th anniversary as a nation state, says we want to do reconciliation with Indigenous populations or with racialized populations that have been systemically targeted for genocide or exclusion. Let's be cynical about that, right? On the other hand, I think we want to pay attention to is the dynamic of power. Like, the Canadian or American governments have a lot of power, and when they ask for reconciliation, what they mean is, please let us continue to oppress people and hold on to our power without fighting back. And the same can be true, I think, of someone who is, a sexual abuser or a predator in communities, and there, you know, there always tend to be some folks who do predatory things in community, for better, definitely for worse, but, you know, but we don't know why these things are necessarily. Mm-hmm. And those aren't folks who necessarily want to change. Those might be folks who, like, want to do bad stuff and get away with it. Or the person who wears a culturally appropriative costume, like a white person who wears a Chang Sam to a party, for example, and, you know, does, like, a geisha girl kind of a mockery of East Asian culture, doesn't necessarily want to change herself or himself or whatever. Mm-hmm. They might just want to be like, I want to wear this costume and you can't be mean to me about it. Well, that's not accountability. That's not making room for mistakes because the person has admitted that they made a mistake. Mm. On the other hand, I think a lot about trans women, because I am a trans woman, right? And trans women tend to get excluded from activism. I think about how trans women I know who tend to be class marginalized, race marginalized, often have mental health issues because of trauma, don't have access to healthcare, can be sometimes loud, can be sometimes aggressive. I myself have been aggressive as a trans woman because that's the only way I've known to get my needs met. I think about how sometimes in community spaces for trans people, trans women, especially for some reason older trans women, have come up to me and been aggressive in ways that I didn't like, that made me uncomfortable, like commented on my body or touched me physically to like comment on like, oh, your boobs are really nice, you know, or like ask me really invasive questions about like if I've had surgery or not, you know, and it made me feel uncomfortable. Now, I really think about that when I think about that, like, okay, so I'm in a trans community space. There's so much rhetoric around safe space in activist communities, and it's true, I deserve to feel safe, especially in a space that's created for trans people. These older trans women should not be doing this. On the other hand, I think about, like, okay, like, what is it like to be a trans woman engaged in the world? Oh, that means, like, developing different mannerisms. That means, like, needing to be aggressive in order to be heard. That means having mental health issues, and those mental health issues tying into our survival tactics to sometimes mean we look crazy or aggressive, and that we will make people uncomfortable because the world is making us uncomfortable, right? Like, this world is being hostile. And so when I think about that, that means I really have to shift the way I think about how I'm going to react. Like, I could react and, like, you know, be like, okay, the organizers of this space should kick out these people who have made me uncomfortable. I should never have to see them again. Well, this space is for me and for me to feel safe. And that, of course, is like a very individualist way to think about activism and consent politics and identity politics. But if I were to shift to a more relational model, if I were to think about all those different ideas, about those different factors of other trans women's identity, then I start to think about, like, okay, maybe actually what the space needs to do is hold us both so that I feel supported in saying, actually, you can't touch me or like ask me questions about my genitalia. But you also are experiencing some of the same struggles I am and some different ones I might not know about. And the space can support you to shift your relationship with me. And so, you know, I guess what I'm saying is that we can really have a more relational model of activism in which we think about, like, okay, if someone is making a mistake and they have less access to not make mistakes, or if the world is being is treating them in such a way that, you know, they're being that, of course, you know, that their behaviors and personalities are shaped to not look like the idea of white middle class safety that activism tends to center, then we can suddenly create new possibilities.
Yeah. Okay. And then moving on to number five, you talked about value intention and action more than correct language. I know you've talked a little bit about that, but do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, not too much. I mean, I think it speaks for itself, right?
Yeah. Okay. And then moving into, which I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about this. This number six was learning the art of calling in versus calling out. Can you say more about that?
Again, I mean, I think this article is kind of dated, I have to say. So, you know, calling in, oh no, I can't even remember, is a concept. I think it was coined by an East Asian queer activist writer writing for Black Girl Dangerous. But I know that there was some debate around who coined this term too, so I really want to be careful about it. Calling in is a concept that's become popularized now in certain activist circles about this, which is the idea that you can collect your folks. If someone has done something harmful and they are in relationship with you, then you can reach out to them and tell them in a loving, although, you know, firm way that they need to, you know, think about themselves. And I think that's really true. On the other hand, now this art, this talking point has, you know, spiraled way beyond the article that I wrote, or that the original, I think, whoever it was who coined the term calling in, has, you know, that discussion has spiraled into, like, tone policing and, like, people using the idea of calling in to shield themselves from accountability. So I don't want to get too into it, except that, you know, maybe what I can add to that is, like, as a couple and family therapist, as someone who, you know, really values connection and community, what I want to prioritize in at least my relationships is like a model of trust and like believing that the people that I have placed my trust in have the ability to change, and that's when I call them in. When someone does something to me that is violent, who I do not trust or whom I know probably is not going to shift their values, or who, you know, is in such a position of power over me that, you know, it's not safe for me to call them in, then I might call them out, but also I might not do that. I think what I'm where I am in my life right now, and I think a lot of folks that I'm talking to also are in, is that, like, maybe both calling in and calling out are limited terms, that maybe there is a different range of ways that we can engage or not engage with oppressive behaviors or oppressive people that centers our community more than conflict.
Right. Wow. That was nice. Yeah. Okay. Moving on. And maybe I should add, I'm catching a theme that a lot of these things are always in motion, right?
And
could you say something to our listeners, you know, maybe how to, you know, embrace the ambiguity, so to speak, of, you know, participating in activism or doing some of this work? Or would you have anything to say? I mean, how have you kind of faced a lot of this movement and motion in this work?
That's a really great question, and I love it, because I think it really, I think thinking about this allows me to bring the thoughts in that article forward, right?
Right.
To build on it in a particular way. And I think, you know, as therapists or folks who are interested in mental health, we can appreciate the concept of development, right? Like development and also community development. So an individual, of course, grows from childhood to adolescence to adulthood. And then maybe if you're a trans woman of color, you're horribly murdered before you can reach middle adulthood. Right. Dark joke. You know, as we move forward, we shift, you know, and I know for me, the journey through activism has been one that has accompanied my development as a person. And I think when I think about my friends and my chosen family, we as a community too have developed through an activism that was perhaps younger and more naive, also more violent and less aware of different, less aware of eldership and less aware of kinship networks. As we move, we have started to think about love and centering love, and you know, these ideas that are reflected by great thinkers in our time, like bell hooks, for example, has written that book about love, about centering love and activism and in all of life. And so, you know, these things move from an individual level to a community level to a wider collective level. All of us are evolving, and this is the gift that we give the next generation, that we have had a cycle of thoughts that hopefully has evolved and become more refined. We have tools that have also evolved and become more refined. And so, you know, I think that something that was really comforting to me at first in activism was the solidity. The idea that, you know, someone said something racist and they were bad forever and I didn't have to be friends with them, right?
Right.
Or that if someone said to me, I'm not a feminist because et cetera, you know, I never had to engage that person. I knew what was right and wrong. And particularly in looking at myself as an individual therapeutically, I can say, like, and I also, like many young people, believed I was fundamentally bad. And actually, there's a lot of people, right? I believed I was fundamentally wrong and full of shame. Maybe that also comes from my Christian upbringing that taught me I was full of sin. And I could use activism in the same way a lot of folks, a lot of younger adolescents also use Christianity or other kinds of religion. I could use the rules to always be good. And then, of course, that became stifling and awful because as I tried to apply doctrine in a static, undeveloping way, I was like, okay, well, like this doesn't work at all. Like, it doesn't actually apply to my life. It doesn't fit with the doctrine doesn't fit with my ideals, actually. I can't, this idea that I should always call someone out doesn't work. This idea that I should always call some people in doesn't work. You know, like, right. You know, it always is changing. And then I realized, okay, well, so this is where freedom comes from. Freedom comes from the knowledge that actually I have a set of values around equity. My values are around freedom. My values are around justice and kindness. And, you know, those values are a compass, but they are not a map. It's really, I think, you know, one of the most powerful things we can do in our activism is acknowledge that our tools and our frameworks have to change. Because when we do that, we start to be able to adapt our ideas and our practices to each contextualized moment in every relationship, which of course, you know, are always changing anyway. Octavia Butler is a Black woman science fiction writer who's really popular now among, like, you know, a certain set of activists, particularly queer, Black, Indigenous, and trans people of color. And a central theme in her book was change. Everything you change, you touch. And this is too what we have to become, I think, in order to survive this increasingly fascist era that we live in. We have to be ready to adapt and change ourselves and you know, maybe this is what I was trying to speak to in the article in a less developed way or just in a younger way perhaps, that that instead of maybe there is more liberation to be had in connecting with each other around positive change than attempting to police each other or to control each other's behavior and thoughts so that we can be correct. Instead of doing that, maybe we can try and evolve together towards something that is better.
That's great. Okay, the final three, I'm just going to name them off so maybe we can just cover them. Yeah, so 7, 8, 9 were acknowledge and break down activist hierarchies. 8, value everyone's contributions. And 9, center love. Would you be willing to say something about that? A, maybe how to break down these hierarchies, and then I love that, moving into everyone's contributions and then centering love.
Sure, and I can wrap those all together for sure.
Perfect.
Because they all speak to the same point, right? Which is, I think that maybe similar to the Christian community that I grew up in as a child, activist communities, have certain people like celebrities, right? And you know, certain people long to be seen and are instead erased and invisibilized, particularly those who are more marginalized. And suddenly, sometimes activism seems more like this like really exhausting space that is either centered around the hopeless, nihilistic pursuit of an impossible ideal, or it's about like looking at everyone and being like, you're fucked up and you're fucked up and you're fucked up. And, and then someone points at you and says, well, you're fucked up too. And then everyone just feels bad, you know? You know, and as someone who has, you know, has put out a couple books and is a therapist and, you know, obviously I like talking. I became activist famous after a certain amount of time in my own small communities. And of course there are people who are way more activist famous than me. It's a hierarchy, right?
Right.
And, you know, I remember being angry and sad and jealous about that when I was younger. And so my response to that, I think, is like to try and resist. I don't know how successful I am about this, but I think, you know, we need to resist the idea that we should or we should try to become activist leaders or celebrities. This idea of leadership and celebrity, of course, is not unique to activist community. It comes from capitalism. And I mean, I remember being a kid and being taught to be a leader and being put in all these leadership programs. Instead of being leaders or like trying to separate ourselves into leaders and followers, and maybe instead we should be trying to foster critical thought in each one of us and the ability to respect our own individual boundaries and to say, okay, well, this is for me and this is not for me, and I choose to live my life in this way and not in this other way, right? Like a true understanding of what diversity, not just in identity and representation might be, but actual diversity of thought, values and behavior that is still liberatory. So when I think about respecting everyone's contributions, I really mean that. Like everyone who is in a community is in some way trying to be free, trying to survive, trying to be loved. Most people too are trying to be connected to others. Most of us are also trying to help others in some way, whether that's just our close friends and family or, you know, on a broader scale.
Sure.
All of these things are inherently valuable, and we have a lot to learn from each one of these things. The idea that we should look to even the greatest of the great thinkers, right? Like bell hooks or Octavia Butler is a flawed idea. These are, I think that those folks themselves would dispute the idea that their words should be taken as doctrine or as some kind of reverse activist gospel. Because when I think about all those writers, most of them are trying to foster, once again, like this idea of unique individual thought and like developing like a moral compass within ourselves that we can follow. So, you know, that's what we need to do, I think, is like look not to the poet who is always making brilliant speeches or performing brilliant pieces on stage, or the artist or the YouTuber who's always making brilliant pieces, which is what we tend to do in activist community, unfortunately, or to the person who's always doing the most direct action, right? Like getting there in the front line, but looking instead to our neighbors or to our lovers, like, oh, like my lover cooks for me all the time. Oh, my lover is teaching me a lot. Oh, my parents are shifting their ways of thinking or supporting me financially while I go through a really hard time. All of these contributions are really important to contextualize within activism, and so that's what I think we need to do. And when I come to centering love, I mean, God, I've already spoken about that a lot. Just to say, like, we have a lot of rage, right? We have a lot of despair also. These things are important because they fuel us and power us, but we also have the capacity to love. We have the capacity to love ourselves and to love each other. And I think that this, in the end, is the value at the center of the compass, right? Is that foundation that allows us to say, all right, so the doctrine has failed. Calling in has failed. Calling out has failed. Feminism has failed, right? Like anti-racism fails us. Intersectionality will fail us at some points too, as a framework for analysis. Our best friends and our communities will fail us. But if we still love each other, then we can evolve through that. We have the faith through love that this can change. And so this, you know, this is really what I hope to keep on pursuing as I move forward in activism, but also just in life, which in the end, of course, is an activism in itself.
Yeah, thank you for that. Okay, I want to, again, thank you very much for the time. This was a wonderful conversation. But before I let you go, how can people find you? And I know you're pretty active writing and such, and like you said, you had a couple of books out. What projects do you have in motion, or what do you want to share, anything that you're doing currently that people might be interested in?
Oh, that's a great question, and I love being asked it. Thank you so much. So there are a couple, there are a couple things I have to plug, because, you know, you got to plug things.
Sure.
I want to plug two great publishers. One is Arsenal Pulp Press, which has been doing a lot of work in Canada for a while and putting out a bunch of books, including my own. I think two or three decades in history of publishing queer and feminist lit and also anti-racist and queer people of color lit in on Turtle Island or North America. And then Metonymy Press is a two-person publishing company that's put out a bunch of works in Montreal, including a book of mine. And they have put out amazing work by trans women of color, including Jiaqing Wilson-Yang, whose novel Small Beauty just won a Lambda Literary Award, which is really important to read. They've also just put out a new edition of Trish Sala's book of poetry, Lyric Sexology, which is a seminal piece in trans women of color lit. So those are two places where people can find my work and also other people's work, Arsenal Pulp Press and Metonymy Press. That's Metonymy space Press. Folks Google that, they can find it. Yeah. And then to the rest of the question, I'm just going to say, don't find me. I'm easy to find. Like, you can Google me and find my articles or whatever. But, in the spirit of this conversation and this and the article and also maybe where I'm trying to come from is don't look for me. I'll be around. And instead of spending that time being oh, Kai Cheng is cool, which you might do, look at yourself and be like, I'm cool. Look for the, poet or novelist or writer or, community caregiver or great manicurist or whatever it is in yourself instead. That person is much more important to find than me.
That's awesome. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time. And
thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me know when this podcast goes up.
Of course. Of course. Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the work you do. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. We really appreciate the support. And I'm going to provide links for Kai Cheng's website and also the publishers mentioned in the show notes. So if you want to track that down and support their efforts, please do, and just follow the links to do that. So, as always, go find us on social media, on Instagram at The Radical Therapist, on Twitter at The Rad Therapist, our website at theradicaltherapist.com. And please, if you want to reach out to me, I always like to hear from you. Just do it at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And let's have a conversation. So as always, my name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist, and we appreciate you listening.